Much of the Wasatch Front's air quality particulate problems, nearly 60%, come from people driving cars. Still, Lane Beatty, the president and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber, says our air quality is now actually cleaner than it used to be decades ago. Why, he asks? Today on the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour, another in a series of campus community dialogues organized by the College of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of Utah, talking about the balance between the economy and caring for and protecting the environment. That discussion's coming up, but first, this news. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Ross Chambliss. The environment and the economy are seemingly in constant conflict in American public discourse and public policymaking these days. And while some continually tout free enterprise and the power of markets to solve problems, the harmful side effects to our environment and public health can be overlooked and even ignored. On the other hand, government regulation to protect the environment has been accused of overreach and hurting the economy. So where is the balance? What can be learned from listening to the other side? Today on the program, we're airing another in a series of campus community dialogues organized by the College of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of Utah about the economy and the environment. Speakers were asked to focus on two main questions. How should we think about the relationship between the economy and the environment? And what are the best ways to balance economic growth with environmental protections, both domestically and globally? The panelists in today's discussion include Val Hale, the executive director of the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development, Lane Beatty, the president and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber, Alan Matheson, the executive director of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, Professor Brenda Bowen with the Global Change and Sustainability Center at the University of Utah, and the conversation was moderated by Natalie Gochner, an associate dean with the School of Business and director of the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute at the University of Utah, and Gochner is also a former administrator with the EPA. This forum was recorded on March 27th.
Did not know the impact that they economic practice of discounting the future ignores the costs of what we are doing now on generations to follow. The risks associated with climate change and environmental degradation affect everyone everywhere, but are unevenly distributed. Today, there's a greater risk for disadvantaged people everywhere. Clean water that won't make you sick and lower the IQ of your offspring should not be a luxury. Why should climate change refugees, Maldivians who are now forced to evacuate their drowning islands, where their grandparents taught them to live in harmony with the environment, have to abandon their lives and cultures so that we, the richest few, can benefit from cheap energy? Our current economic paradigms pose the greatest risk for people of the future, our children and our children's children. I am a mom, and I've actually had my 8-year-old son come to me in sincere, outraged tears and scream at me, "Way to go, Mom, nice job screwing up the planet and leaving me to deal with it." What do you say? We need a cheap energy so that a few privileged white men could make more money? We knew that we were poisoning our water and filling our ocean with garbage, but we needed to keep biggering and throwing away our disposable luxuries? How can we justify these decisions to our children? We need to find a way to imagine a prosperous economy that is not predicated on natural resource extraction and environmental degradation. Until we can imagine what this even looks like, we should be doing everything possible to reduce the negative consequences of our current system. Our current economy is built on the back of cheap, abundant, fossil fuel-based energy, and we are now seeing the environmental consequences of that dependence as our planet warms. This fossil energy has powered everything: electricity, heat, industry, transportation, buildings, agriculture, and we now need to forge a new path forward for a total global energy transition to renewable and non-carbon energy sources. We have the needed technology and the scientific knowledge to do this, and the rest of the world is on board with this. What we lack are leaders with the will and courage to enact new policies that promote financial incentives to make this transition. A publication in the journal Science just this week laid out a viable roadmap for rapid decarbonization of the energy sector, a necessity as the Paris Agreement has now become international law. This transition will not be without new challenges. A study published in Nature this month makes a case for longer-term resource conservation planning to provide the metals that will be needed to facilitate this energy transition. They show that at our current rate of consumption and continued population growth, we'll have exhausted all raw copper from our planet by the end of this century, within the next 80 years. So we'll require a new circular economy that is based entirely on renewable resources. Resources currently tied up in our excessive infrastructure. Preserving antiquated, cheap energy systems does not benefit Utahns. It devalues our land, our air, our water, our health, and does not factor in the essentially, I think it comes down to identifying what we as a society value. Can we recognize and understand our place within interconnected ecological systems and value the health of our communities over timescales that dwarf individual monetary gains of one company, one developer, one shareholder? We know that landscapes and ecosystems do not exist in isolation, just as economic theory cannot be considered as an abstraction independent of biophysical realities. The land, plants, atmosphere, and animals, including human animals with our infrastructure, culture, and economies, all interact and impact all other parts of the system. What we choose to do here in Utah, within our businesses, within our governments, here at the university, and in our homes and communities matters on a much larger scale.
Thank you for outlining that. We're going to go to you next, Val, and then we'll go to Mr. Allen, and we'll have you wrap up, Lane. 6 to 8 minutes, Val.
Thank you. I don't believe that economic development and the environment, protecting the environment, are mutually exclusive. I think you can do both, and I think the approach to take, and the approach that Utah has always sought to take, is to do it in moderation. I think that you can see that more and more as we bring tech companies to the state. These tech companies are very concerned about sustainability. They're very concerned about the environment, about the things that we're talking about today. I remember last year Facebook and some of the other data centers that are coming in and locating with these companies, they require basically 100% sustainable energy to function. They are pushing, and by getting a company, about whether Facebook was a good deal or not, but by bringing companies like that, it actually speeds up the process of getting sustainable energy because they require, they demand it. We're seeing more and more of that in our technology companies that come here. And I really believe that to succeed in business today, you have to be concerned about the environment. I think that companies now view that positive, not as a negative, and they like to use that to market their products. They like to use that to attract employees, and it's across the scale. I think that you see a lot of these companies really pushing that and promoting that, and then even the buildings. You know, eventually, after we get Tier 3 fuel here in the state, Alan's the expert on this. You're going to see. The largest source of pollutants in the future are going to be our buildings. And if you go down to Lehigh, for example, and look at all these new buildings that are being built, I would guess that a large percentage of them are LEED certified buildings. It's very important. In fact, Utah, let's see, I had a statistic here. I think Utah is 10th in the nation in LEED buildings per capita that are being built. And so it's really something that's important in our economic development and in these companies that are coming here. I think, you know, the issue of regulation, the governor's approach, and I think to the same extent maybe the legislature's approach, is we want to promote sustainability, we want to promote all of these environmental issues, but we want to do it in a reasonable, rational way that is not going to hurt the economy, that really helps to pay for our schools, to fund our highways, to fund higher education, all of these things that we need to have a balance, and we need to go about doing it in a reasonable, responsible way. Now, you look at California. Most people would say that California has gone to the extreme in terms of regulations, and they are having a mass exodus of business out of California. A lot of it, they didn't have warm weather and beaches. Really interesting to see how many businesses would stay there in California. We talk to businesses on a regular basis who are just tired of it and say, we can't do business here. And they either open new branches of their operation, they will no longer expand in California, or they just decide to leave altogether. And here in Utah, we've been the beneficiary of that because we've tried to approach regulation in a responsible way. We want to make sure that we are doing things more big deal to those on the left politically, not to those on the right. I would say today, everybody across the board is focused on that. I don't care where you go along the Wasatch Front, people on both sides of the political spectrum say, we've got to fix this. Now, how we go about fixing it, that's the debate, that's the issue. And, you know, but we are making progress. Alan, I'm sure we'll mention that. So, as we move forward and in the state, we want to do it in a responsible manner that continues to focus on environmental protections and environmental improving the environment without the detriment to our economy that has really been driving our quality of life and what we've done here in Utah that has been so successful and is today held up as the number one economy in America.
And that was Val Hale, the Executive Director of the Utah Governor's Office for Economic Development. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. On this program, as you know, we record and broadcast the many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them for you as a public service. And today on the program, we're airing a campus community dialogue recorded on March 27th and organized by the College of Social and Behavioral Science about the economy and the environment. The moderator was Natalie Gochner, the Associate Dean of the School of Business and Director of the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute. And earlier in introducing the program, Natalie Gochner said, quote, "Some preach free enterprise and the invisible hand, but frequently fail to acknowledge the market's invisible foot. Others are quick to deploy government's regulatory power, but often fail to strike a reasonable balance to the economy. Far too often we talk more than we listen and fail to learn from the other side." Well, where can the balance between the economy and caring for the environment be found? The panelists in this discussion hoping to find that place are Val Hale, the Executive Director of the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development, Lane Beatty, the President and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber, Alan Matheson, the Executive Director of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, and Professor Brenda Bowen with the Global Change and Environment and Sustainability Center at the University of Utah. Here's the moderator, Natalie Gochner. Probably on the extreme, but almost anybody would say benefits to society, health, economy, etc. have been a plus. But within the Clean Air Act, there's some problems. I'll just mention one as well.
actually quickly to reduce the amount of ozone that's formed, precursors to that ozone, before we get designated as a contaminant area. Problem is, if they take action now, they don't get any credit under the Clean Air Act. So the Clean Air Act creates incentive to get to non-attainment before you can start getting better. You shouldn't have to get worse before we get better. So there are things that can be done in terms of regulation. To give other examples, let's turn to the cost of the community, the society, paid for with taxes. Infrastructure is a big part of that. There's kind of a classic example of this. Look at New York City in the 90s. They were faced with the need for additional treatment of their water system to improve the quality, to meet regulatory standards, but also to meet the growing population. The engineers came together and they said, to build the treatment facilities, it's going to cost us $8 billion. That translates into fees and taxes. As they thought about it, they decided to take a different approach. And for $1.5 billion fraction, they went into the Catskill Mountains. They purchased land that was critical. They provided some funding to farmers and ranchers in the area to minimize pollution going into the streams, fence them off cattle from streams and other things. Throughout that, they were able to meet the regulatory standards. It's kind of a win-win-win, isn't it? Save money for everybody. Number two, those that lived in the Catskills got paid for things they had previously been providing free. And third, a win for conservation. Where would you rather spend a weekend? Catskills or the treatment plant? So then we go and look a little bit at those raw materials, the inputs. There are many. I'll give another example here. So, Coca-Cola Company, what's their biggest input? Water. They need water. And they found that in many parts of the world where they were operating, they were concerned about the long-term sustainability of their water sources. They were also facing some PR challenges when wells would dry up and communities would be complaining that Coca-Cola was taking more water. So, as an example, down in Latin America, there's a bottler. It's the biggest Coca-Cola bottler in the world. It spans 9 countries. And they started looking at things differently and started saying, we ought to be investing in the watershed to preserve the health of the forests, to absorb water and release it cleaner and regular. They also started a process of saying, look, by the year 2020, we're going to ensure that we're putting as much water back into the environment as we take out. So they've been working around the world. They actually had a project here in Utah to do that. They put about $10 million into the East Fork of the Bear River and helped move some diversion structures farther down to allow greater flows for fish for several miles and put in some conservation measures so that the farms would use less water. Then finally, this piece on profitability, there's a little quote I want to get into. There's some researchers at Harvard Business School and London Business School that looked at 18 years of data on different companies. And this was their conclusion. Failure to have a culture of sustainability is quickly becoming a source of competitive disadvantage. The argument about sustainability is over. It is the key to creating value for shareholders and all other stakeholders over the long term, thus ensuring the sustainability of the company itself. Here's an example of that. In the Seadrift plant of Dow Chemical in Texas, they needed to upgrade their treatment facility.
And so we've had Dr. Bowen basically, you know, say we need to have a long-term view on this, and we've had both our economic development leader and our environmental leader in state government say, hey, we can, these two things, we can do, we can make them work, we can find the balance, they can complement each other. How do you respond representing Utah's largest business community?
It's a lot simpler than I'm going to take, and that is that we have to respond. We have to respond in a positive way. I happen to believe very strongly that more businesses today are more minded from an environmental standpoint than most people believe. The encouragement of employees to participate in programming, everything from how they travel to get there to the number of people that have to come into the office every day are major issues that corporations in the state of Utah continue to struggle with on a daily basis. Some do excellent, some are struggling, and some, unfortunately, are not approaching it at all. The reality is that we are in a very defined area here in the state of Utah. We are in the Great Basin, and there are some things that affect us from an environmental standpoint that are a deep concern to businesses. They're a concern to those that are growing and those that want to come here to grow. In 1989, we were losing about 14,000 people a year out of the state of Utah because they couldn't find jobs at enough of an income to actually support their families, and so they moved out. And we weren't dropping in population because we continued to produce more people than that in the state of Utah, and to this day, that continues to be very true. The reality is by the 1990s, a lot of those people started to move in. As I would go around the state of Utah, it was a little bit alarming to me and a surprise to how many people would say, I'm sick and tired of all of the Californians moving in here and telling us how we have to live. When in the reality, if you looked at the people who were moving in, they weren't just Californians, they were Utahns moving home. The huge percentage of people, many of them not even born here, but had some values to want to come back to the state of Utah. There was the religious that most people are hesitant to ever even mention in a public setting that draw people back. But quality of life is still the one that is one of the most important. You look at major corporations that have come to Utah in the business community. One that was particularly important to us was Goldman Sachs. Goldman Sachs, because of who they are, I didn't even know they were in Utah, to be honest with you. When I came to the Chamber of Commerce, I got a call one day. These men came in, sat down, and said, we were going to grow our company. And I said, well, help me understand who you are. And they said, well, we're with Goldman Sachs. And I said, you're going to grow in Utah? Where are you? And they said, we're at the University of Utah. I said, where are you at the University of Utah? And they said, we're at Research Park. I said, you do research? At the Research Park? Oh, no, no, we support literally on a global basis a lot of different interests of Goldman Sachs from a financial standpoint. And we have about 200 employees. And I went, wow, and how much are you going to grow? And they said, well, we think we can go up to maybe even 400 or 500 people. And I said, well, that's great because they love to hire people from the locations that they're in, and I thought that'd be a great advantage. Well, as time went on, that changed. And they decided because of the efficiency of Utah employees that they would even grow more than that, that there was something unique here. Well, there's a long story to all of this. They ended up growing a lot more than they anticipated. We now have the third largest Goldman Sachs office in the world. But what was important to them when they came, which speak of the environment and business, what was important to them is, did we have light rail? And where did it go? Did it deliver people to their front door? Could they actually use it instead of a car? Because of the quality of the individuals that they hired was very, very important to them. Quality of life. They wanted a place they could literally have what Utah presents to them from the outdoor life that they had. But they also wanted the quality to be able to live, work, learn, and play near their employment. That was very important to them. Well, they've continued to come. They continue to grow along with many, many other people. There are other companies in the state of Utah that spend a great deal of time and effort within their company to be able to find out what it is that is sensitive about the environment. I want you to know we've come a long way. About 130 years ago in the state of Utah, we organized the Salt Lake Chamber. It's 130 years old.
know what they called it? They called it that they couldn't hang out their laundry without it coming back in gray. Why? Because everybody was on coal dust. That's how they heated their homes. It was inevitable that there was going to be a problem. Very little that we have been able to find talked about what the doctor says today. We know because of the fact of what it does to lungs and environment and health and strength and growth. And it's become something much more important. Today, if I'm not mistaken, the statistics that we have talked about before, is about 12% of the air quality issues that we have come from industry. You're kidding. If it's 12%, where's all the rest of it coming from? From us. From people. From how we live. And yet, are we doing something? I have 9 grandchildren. I want you to know, the most environmental people that I know are my grandchildren. They're the ones that say, Grandpa, you should turn off your car in the parking lot. Why is that? Why are they taking the time? What are they learning? They talk about those things that I happen to believe are very, very important. It's because when they enter the workforce, they're going to be much more mindful of the cost of what we're doing. Now, the greatest thing is that we're cleaner today than we were several years ago. Why? Because of regulation. Now you ask me, the business leader in the state of Utah, what do I think of regulation? Do I think that regulation has helped us as a state? Absolutely, without question. Do we need that regulation? Yes, unfortunately, we do. And the fact that we're talking about Tier 3 and the environment and getting cleaner fuels all of the time, but we also need to talk about using them less. What do we do? You cannot clean the air in Utah unless we have the opportunity that we have of mass transit. That is a huge advantage. And yet, we're not doing it all the best that we can yet, but we can. Those are the things that we continue to bring business leaders together through the chamber and ask, how can we do this? What are the things that we can do to encourage you? One of the most active committees that we have happens to be the air quality initiative that we have. Is it a problem? I don't care if it's 18 days or 24 days or 100 days. It is a major issue in the state of Utah. It should be a major issue in the state of Utah. We need to find ways that we can go about encouraging people to help clean our environment by what they do in the environment. One of the biggest problems that we have is that how many moms do we have in multiple trips every day just to deliver kids to what they do today? I told some people about 3 years ago that we were talking about some issues in the state of Utah, and I said, how many of you, when you grew up, can you remember how many times a week you ate out, meaning went to a restaurant? Now, I want you to know what I said to them. I grew up in Centerville. I remember both times. Both times that my family went out to eat in a restaurant. I can't tell you how many times last week I went out to eat in a restaurant. Life has changed completely. Does that impact our environment? Absolutely. Businesses are sensitive to it. We're trying to help find solutions by listening to good dialogue. Not just the ranting, not just the extremes, although I must say, they are extremely important. We will not move unless we have the extremes. We have to have people to literally lay in front of us what it is that's really going to make a difference. And then we need to find a solution to that. About the last thing I want to say is just about water. The state of Utah has talked about water for many, many years. It is a sacred issue. From farmers, from my grandparents, and the way they talked about the wars that they had even here in Utah over water. And yet today, even in the time I was in the legislature, which has been 17 years ago, by the way, I was always
That was Lane Beatty, the president and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour here on KCPW. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts of more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
And thanks for listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Ross Chambliss. Today on the program, we're airing another in a series of campus community dialogues organized by the College of Social and Behavioral Science, and it's about the economy and the environment. And the panel today includes Val Hale, the Executive Director of the Utah Governor's Office of Economic Development, Lane Beatty, the President and CEO of the Salt Lake Chamber, Alan Matheson, the Executive Director of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, Professor Brenda Bowen with the Global Change and Sustainability Center based at the University of Utah. And the conversation was moderated by Natalie Gochner, the director of the Kem C. Gardner Policy Institute and herself a former administrator with the EPA.
Okay, so this is where I tell all of you to get your questions ready. I'm going to break the ice by asking a question of a panelist. But right after that, we'll go to you in the audience and we'll go for about 25 minutes of just asking questions. You can direct it to a panelist or just throw it out there and see who wants to. I want to come back to you, Professor Bowen, because it was so interesting, and I commend the university for bringing, you know, the top business representative in our state, the top economic development representative, and the top environmental, you know, representative, at least in state government, how it's structured. I would love you to just give a little response to what you heard, because what I heard is they're saying, we care about the environment, we're going to find ways to work together, and these things can be complementary, economic growth, environment. I thought it'd be great to hear you respond to that.
Sure, I'd be happy to respond.
And then after that, we're going to go to your questions, so get ready.
You know, I think it's one thing to say, sure, we support caring about the environment. That's easy to say. But what about our practices of, you know, who we employ, where we get our resources, what are the regulations that we're willing to go above and beyond to improve things? And no one addressed this issue of carbon emissions, that we need to enter a new economy that we're not talking about. And so how are we going to do this if we can't talk about it? We need a completely new way of, you know, providing the energy for these systems that we're just really used to and we're so entrenched in. And so I think we need to start having some really hard conversations about what our businesses are actually doing, and to you know, put any blame on, well, sure, individuals make choices, but we are limited in our choices by what our society and our governments and our industries allow us to do. And, you know, moms driving their kids to school, I think, are the last ones we should be blaming for things like emissions. So I think there's bigger picture carbon issues that we need to get at.
Very good. Okay, let's go to the audience, and we're going to have you wait till the microphone, and we'll start over here with Lena.
Hi, I'm Lena Svedin. I just want to thank the panelists for their contributions. This is a really interesting start off. I'm asking about leadership. It sounded to me, like the gentleman from the governor's office, that it's not until businesses who are thinking about moving here require things like clean energy that we are thinking about, oh, maybe we have to have some clean energy in this state. To me, that isn't leadership, that's followership. And that can be okay, but I think a state as great as Utah should be able to do more thinking ahead and leading for clean energy and more sustainable thinking. Great.
Val, I'd love to hear your response to that.
I agree 100%. And we are leading in a lot of these areas. For instance, in solar energy, we're number 5. Manner that won't impact our economic growth as well. hard to get people to do some of those things because they're not the way we've always thought, not the way we've always lived. My wife and I, a few years ago, said, let's invest and pay money to bring in one of those recycling bins to our house. We've never been big recyclers other than newspaper. Now we recycle everything. So I think it takes all of us making those commitments, and it's not always easy. It's not always cheap. But if we're going to make a real impact, as Lane said, it's individuals that are going to have the big impact, and businesses that need to come along with that.
That's very good. Okay, we got another question right here. We'll keep moving around. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I'd like to, for the panel as a whole, go back to one of the original questions posed, the challenge you're facing, about the idea of can a balance be achieved between economic growth and environmental development. What's striking is, as I hear your arguments, while all of you appear to, you know, place a certain value on the environment, what seems to come through, though, is how any kind of balance, success at achieving balance is measured, come from two very different places. So to the three gentlemen, I hear that while environmental sustainability is important, any sort of success is measured against terms of economics, whether it's profitable, cost-effective, and such, where, you know, I hear a counterposition that's saying, you know, we need to be measuring the success of this balance and how physically healthy our community is, how sustainable our environment is. Given this, what I'm seeing is kind of a disconnect or a gap there. Is there, how do we overcome that? Where's the bridge? Is there a common set of values somewhere between economics and physical health and environmental sustainability?
Who wants to tackle that one first?
Go, Alan.
A couple of thoughts. First of all, yes. At the end of the day, we need to have sustainability. Is that the fact is, in society, there are different measures of sustainability. Often you'd say, in business terms, the market can help us get to that place. That works if you've got a functioning market. And I'd say that we're dealing with an imperfect market right now because it's not capturing the externalities of the impact on human health, environment, climate, etc. So if the market's not going to work perfectly, it doesn't have all the information, then you've got to look at regulation gets us right to the fundamental question of government. That is individual rights versus collective rights. Isn't that what political science is all about? Ultimately, where's the balance between individual rights and collective interest? We haven't reached a resolution on that. Society's always been working back and forth to try to find that sweet spot is. So, on one level, you can say we need leadership, we need to measure by science, and I certainly agree with that. But it's not just where you got to go, it's how do you get there? And the reality of society is that to get there, people need to come along with you. Now, let's just give you an example. It was about 2 or 3 years ago where there was a proposal to eliminate wood burning during the winter inversion season. There's good science saying that wood smoke is far more carcinogenic than cigarette smoke. There's good science saying that wood smoke is more of a contributor to the poor air during our inversions than all of industry combined. There's good arguments to be made that why should my having a nice warm fire in my house inflict harm on my neighbors who have to breathe the air? All of those things, I think, are good, sound arguments. What happened? The public wasn't ready. They pushed back. And in fact, the legislature went in and said, all right, now we're going to put additional restrictions on your ability to regulate. So we have to deal with the world of the practical reality. Part of that is you got to work with people. All of us have to come along together.
I don't know if anyone else wants to add anything.
Me?
Yes.
Okay.
You've got the microphone. Let's
yeah,
do
because
it.
I come Stephen Hawking's going around saying we ought to just pack up and leave this universe within 100 years, or this planet. You know, I think that's a little extreme. I kind of like it here. You know, there's a lot of things to see, and there's a lot of things to do. But I'm concerned particularly about some of our non-renewables like plastic. You know, we haven't talked much about that. And, you know, I'd like to, if I could, leave a little plug. There's going to be a film on that by the Utah Film Society on the 4th of April down at the library on plastics and their effects on whales. You know, I'd like to, you know, see what we could do about maybe limiting our resources and using less plastic, using our own bags. You know, things like that as far as plastic and stuff like that on the effect of the environment as well. That's a real concern to me.
Any comments there?
I think you're absolutely right. It is a huge problem, and it's essentially directly linked to our petroleum industry, right? That's where the plastics come from. And so if we can transition to a non-carbon-based energy sector, we can start moving away from a system that's based on those types of resources. And recycling is increasing, right? But we need 100%, not the 40% that we get now. Chances to
the gentleman right in the center.
All right, so there's a lot of talk about individual choices, which I think is really important. But for choices for both individuals and businesses, how do we make those competitive to, like, opting out of those? For example, like, deciding to recycle, how do you make that beneficial to individuals or businesses as opposed to not recycling? Like, what's the benefit that people get from engaging in these other than, like, self-gratification?
Well, I can talk a little bit. You know, one of the big debates going on right now in the legislature that just ended is the value of incentives. You know, incentives are meant to change behavior and to motivate. The legislature voted to remove the incentive for solar installation. And this was, I guess the reason is it started out when solar was fairly new as a way to, hey, we're going to give you a rebate of, was a significant rebate if you'll experiment with this new procedure to put solar on your rooftops. Well, it's become so popular now that the amount that they were anticipating spending was $20 million. It started out as just a few hundred thousand dollars. It was growing, and now it's about $20 million a year. And the interest, so the debate is, at what point does the incentive cease to become necessarily a motivator because it's now an adopted practice to put solar. It's not as in the pioneering stages as it was back 3 years ago. So that was one of the reasons. That debate was going on in the legislature, right or wrong. The whole idea of incentivizing people to change motivation is a fundamental political debate that's happening. About all incentives, but especially about incentives that will motivate you to do something to change your behavior. And it's going to, that debate will continue in the next year and the year after.
But haven't we been incentivizing the coal industry and the oil and gas industry for decades? It's just that that's on an industrial corporate level, and this happens to be homeowners who can make this choice. It's not a new thing, right? And that's the only way that renewable energy will move forward, is if it is incentivized by the government, and which they've been doing for energy forever.
That's true. It's the fossil fuels incentivized.
Yeah.
So a few years ago, when the Western Governors Association was looking at the proposition of weighing in on production tax credit for the energy, there were those
say what we're going to do. We're going to go right here, and then we're going to go in the far back corner and then move up one to you. Let's do these rapid fire, get them done.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I just had a quick question. You mentioned externalized costs, which I think is a really important part of this discussion, and I was just hoping
decided how they were going to build their building and where the use of light and every part of the environment was taken into account, including the materials they used. More and more, we're seeing more and more businesses that are doing that. Are we at the level that we need to be? No, we're not. That's why we need to continue to encourage people to take those steps that are necessary. When we built the buildings downtown Salt Lake City, 22-story high-rise buildings. Are they energy efficient? No. But what's the best they could do? And in both of the cases for 222 and 111, those were really big factors in the development of those buildings. I happen to believe that that's the time, the step we need to move forward. Even in houses where I know some people, because we always like to look at somebody else for the issue. And we look at business, forgetting at times that business is the one that actually is funding all of these incentives themselves by taxation. We are funding it as citizens of the state of Utah. It's very, very important for us. We had a debate 2 years ago about how thick the walls should be in a home. Today, they estimate that the cost of a home in regulation is 25% of the cost of a home is regulation. Where do you draw the line to know which is the good environmental regulations we ought to have, and where are the ones that are maybe not as good? Those are the kinds of things that we were having right here in the state of Utah. Should we force everybody to have 2 to 6 walls so they can insulate appropriately to allow houses to be much more environmental so that we don't continue to pollute from household emissions? Those are things that are very, very important. But businesses are doing a better job than we probably are individually. And that's the kind of thing that we have to keep the pressure on. New companies that come here and they look here, a lot of them are extremely environmentally sensitive towards what we have because of the quality of life that we also have. And that's the part that this gentleman asked. Is there a place that you come together? There better be a place we can come together with these discussions. That we're not going to go to the extremes, but for heaven's sakes, can't we just intelligently sit down and talk about what we can do to make sense out of the environment? And the answer is yes, we can.
Down to probably about 2 more questions, so we're way at the back, and then we're going to come up the aisle to you.
My name's Alan Nauman. I'm in the solar industry, and the 5% might be increasing jobs, but the solar industry, 1% in rooftop solar, that is a baby infant industry being attacked by utilities. Rocky Mountain Power, not alone, but the municipal utilities also putting caps on our ability to operate. The state leadership would need to get cleaner, period. It's a carbon tax on coal. There's coal severance tax on coal in the state of Utah. That's a sub
on the cusp of having some incredible innovation that will be disruptive, and a lot of it depends on battery power. When they develop a battery that allows you to put a battery in your house and capture and store the energy from your solar roof so you can go off the grid, as soon as they get to that point, man, I'm all in on solar. And it will completely disrupt the energy business. When you can put solar on your roof and store the energy in your home, when you can afford, when you can, it's not widely known. I'm not familiar with it, but when it is, let me know.
It's great.
The other thing is our cars. As soon as they're on the verge of getting some great battery-powered vehicles, when we can get away from the combustible engines, it's not very far away. That's going to be another huge step.
That's good. I'm going to make sure we leave 5 minutes at the end here for an evaluation. So we're going to go to the young lady. Is that a nice way to say it? Right in the middle there on the aisle. And then we'll end with you. Oh, okay. You don't have a mic in your hand? Then let's end with you. We'll go here first. Okay.
I'm Steve Bannister. I'm an economist here at the college. And I appreciate the conversation around incentives and so forth. Economists do know that for a commodity like carbon-based energy, increasing price reduces usage. I mean, that's fundamental. So let me phrase the question this way. What are the barriers in Utah of passing an appropriate carbon tax and or which could be in household and or doing equivalent capital?
So the idea here, and I don't know if I'll phrase it exactly right, but the important point there was not to increase revenues, but to change incentives. Yeah, by putting a carbon tax. Lane, maybe you're the best one as a former Senate president.
Yeah, politician, yeah. There's more talk about it today than there has ever been. That's not just an easy thing to say, because I spent 12 years in the legislature. Never once did I have one person come in and talk to me about that in all the time I was there. And so, but today, 17 years later, it's a whole different story. They are looking at possibilities of that. It's a matter of getting
so from our standpoint in our office, when we talk about economic development, we talk about bringing in businesses that will pay good wages, that will be good citizens, that will be, you know, we want to attract clean manufacturing, you know, the jobs that will have a minimal impact on the environment. Not everyone will be that way, but that's the type that we're looking at. So when we refer to economic development, we're talking about bringing in high-paying jobs. That's what we focus on. That will be have minimal impact on our economy. But we have to. We can't ever say we've arrived. I tell the legislature this year, economic development is a journey, not a destination. And because of our growth, we have to continue to bring in jobs. We want to be selective and try to promote those jobs that pay well and have minimal impact on our economy.
That's great. Did you want to ask a quick question? Let's do it. You seem to really want to do it. Let's get it done. And if you speak it loud, I'll repeat it if you want. Wait for the mic.
Thank you.
perhaps having your, not worry about going home and turning your sprinklers off. I have been embarrassed by driving home in a rainstorm and looking out and seeing my pasture being watered. And that kind of technology will help us, I think, in a pretty major way. That shouldn't take away from other incentives, but there's great things that are taking place that way. So I don't want to burst a bubble of nothing being done, but I think there are some things.
That's great. Val?
Just, I think you've given me some great ideas. One of the things I'd like to do is maybe do a better assessment of the overall economic impact of companies coming to our area. And I know we've done a little bit of this with Natalie and her group at the Kempsey Gardner Institute, but we need to do a better job of identifying the real costs, both economically and environmentally, when companies come here to the state. And maybe when it comes to incentivizing them, we offer better incentives to the type of companies that we want here that are going to be good, both economic and environmental stewards. I don't know, Jason Perry's at the back. They may have been doing this when he was in my role, but if they were, they're no longer doing it, and so I think it's something.
Alan, a new idea or theme for you to share?
Well, I think it's important that we ask a couple of questions. One is, where do we want to go in the central? As I mentioned before, is how do we get there? There's political realities that you're messing with. It comes down to priorities. And if the top priority is the environment, we want to put all the resources there. There are many that go up to the hill and say, our top priority is education. If you put subsidies or tax credits, is taking money from my kids. And there are others in social services saying that ought to be a priority. So what you get in politics, of course, is the discussion of priorities. And one of the ways that I think we can get at least closer to aligning priorities is by understanding and aligning our values. There's been some research done that it will got very sophisticated processes. Understand not just what people care about, but why. I want to give you an example that's topical and could have helped us in the last few weeks. There was this values ladder that was done by people in rural Utah regarding public lands. The thought process goes like this. Because of federal control of public lands in our area, we have fewer economic opportunities. Say right or wrong, but this is the thing. Because we have fewer economic opportunities, our children go away to school and have no opportunity to come back. That means I'm going to grow old and die alone. That's the thought process. That's real. That's powerful. And by ignoring that, talking about it in political terms, we lose that. We're not going to change the dynamic. I wish that in the discussion of outdoor retailers, they've done differently. He said, listen, we understand where you're coming from. You need to understand the deep held feelings of people that live down there. They're really worried about growing old and dying alone. And the way to fix that is to get some opportunity in rural areas. You, as outdoor industry people, have an opportunity to help bring some of those opportunities. Even 10 jobs in Canyon County or Wayne County. Had that kind of a discussion, I think we can fence it. I would need to have a bridge.
That's great. Professor Bowen, you start us out. I'm going to let you finish off the panel and share a new idea or thought or anything you'd like to share with the audience after being a part of this discussion.
Thanks. Well, I'm encouraged by the potential to look at things more holistically and try to assess some of these external costs and what we're doing in our businesses and industry and decisions we're making. I still think we need to step even farther back and think about the connections between different parts of the ecosystem and something Alan addressed, which is the strong value on individual rights versus collective interests. You know, right now, if you have a honeybee that flies into someone else's property and it gets poisoned because of things they're doing, it's your fault and you're being trespassed into their property. We so value the rights of individuals to do what they want on their individual property, whatever that polluting or degrading the environment is. And I think we need to look at it from a larger scale perspective of how are we going to see the system as an interconnected thing that we can manage responsibly.
Yeah, very good. Let's give our panel a hand. I was
This has been a campus community dialogue about balancing the economy and the environment, recorded on March 27th and organized by the College of Social and Behavioral Science at the University of Utah. This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Ross Chambliss. Thanks for listening.